Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business, and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
And welcome, welcome everyone, welcome. Well, I'm going to start today's show with a couple of questions, as I sometimes like to do, and these are for you. Do you have a rainy brain or a sunny brain? Why do some people see the glass half empty and others see it half full? And can pessimists, are optimists and pessimists born that way, or can they change? Well, later in today's show, I talk with leading psychologist Professor Elaine Fox, who's cutting-edge research on the subject of optimism and pessimism is breaking new ground. You have to excuse me, I have a scratchy throat this morning. I'm sucking on a lozenge here. It's getting in my way of talking. But whether you have a rainy brain or a sunny brain, Professor Fox shares scientifically based advice to help you thrive on the sunny side of the street. So we'll bring that to you at the second half of today's show. First, we're going to talk about knowing our rights and speaking up for ourselves and our loved ones when we're in medical situations. I don't know, I'm sure many of you have been in situations where you've kind of been bulldozed through the process, or you've left a doctor's office or a hospital with questions that you never raised. So we're going to talk today about rights and responsibilities. And to help us know and navigate through that, I have asked Denise Moscheno from the Joint Commission to join us. Denise joined the Joint Commission in 2007 and is currently, I believe, the Centre Project Lead. But I'm going to bring her on and let her tell you in her own words what the Joint Commission is and what she does there. Denise Moscheno, welcome to the show.
Hi, Vicki. Thanks.
So tell me a little bit, first of all, about the Joint Commission and what the Joint Commission does, why it was founded. I know it's the largest and oldest of its kind, but tell us what the Joint Commission is.
Yeah, the Joint Commission is an accreditor for healthcare organizations, and our mission is really to continuously improve the healthcare for the public. And so a lot of our activities are focused on important patient care initiatives and making sure that everyone receives the safest, best quality care.
And your role there, I know you have a BS in nursing, you have a master's in nursing administration, you've had several roles within the Joint Commission. What do you do there specifically?
Currently I work within a division within the Joint Commission called the Center for Transforming Healthcare, and we focus on some of the biggest healthcare challenges. My role is Center Project Lead, which means I help lead some of the performance improvement initiatives on things like surgical site infections and sepsis and those types of things.
Mm-hmm. Now, you accredit, I think I read that you have accredited 19,000 organizations, medical organizations. Is that about correct?
Yeah. So that includes both hospitals, home care organizations, laboratory services, the whole gamut of different healthcare providers.
And you do that how? By running a survey, I understand, every 2 or 3 years?
Right. So a big aspect of what we do at the Joint Commission is create standards for healthcare in those organizations. And then we have some leaders within healthcare industry that go out and survey organizations against those standards.
Okay. And so then I have a question then. So you're accrediting these organizations, these medical facilities, you're holding them accountable to certain standards, otherwise they don't get recredited, presumably. Who holds you accountable to keeping those standards? What kind of transparency does the Joint Commission have?
Well, part of our process at the Joint Commission is we work with a lot of national healthcare organizations when we're creating our standards, so we get a lot of input from the public in that manner. Also, our board is made up of representatives from those leading organizations, so that's part of the accountability that we have. Another aspect is some of our programs are working with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Certainly, we have accountability within them to make sure that our standards fit those regulations.
Okay. And so how much do you work with the public versus working with the hospital facilities, Denise?
A lot of what we do is directly with healthcare organizations, but some of what we're going to be talking about today, the Speak Up campaign, really is specifically directed to the public. So not just with healthcare organizations, but with consumers of healthcare.
Yeah. So, for example, you just mentioned the Speak Up campaign, which I think is awesome, and the reason that I got in touch with you in the first place. If somebody has questions, you pretty much cover a whole range of different topics. When I was looking there, I mean, in the Speak Up campaign, you caused, you know, what we need to know about pain management, helping to prevent errors in our care, things we can do to prevent infection, tips for doctor's visits. How do you come up with all of these issues? I'm assuming that, you know, people write to you or contact you and say, hey, this was an issue. And is that how you respond?
Yeah, there's a lot of different ways that we get information on what needs to be included in the Speak Up campaign. Certainly, like you had said, we survey organizations and find out what are some of the big areas and their interests and where they lie. Also, within the Joint Commission, we're fortunate to get a lot of data on what are some of the biggest challenges in healthcare. So we look at when unfortunate events occur in organizations, and then we look at those top areas and figure out what do we need to focus on next within the Speak Up initiative.
Okay, well, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to talk more about knowing our rights and the Speak Up campaign. I want to talk about some specifics around that. My guest in this segment is Denise Moschano. She's from the Joint Commission, and you're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
OMG! Grammar abuse is no LOL! Hire a copywriter today and make sure your business communications rise above the crowd and deliver the results you need. Call 800-495-7617 today. BTW, IMHO, copywriters rule. Call 800-495-7617. BFN!
Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair discusses issues that are important to you, like good health and well-being, finding a new job and building your business, overcoming life's big challenges and making sense out of chaos, and living with passion and joy. Join us Mondays at noon Pacific for Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. See conversationslive.net for show schedule and guest information. Are you a foodie? Do you love to eat, shop, blog? Do you dream of cooking your way to success? And on another note, what happens when someone at work takes credit for your idea? How do you feel when someone invents something you thought of years ago? And do you have a big idea that you'd like to get off the ground? We'll answer these questions and more on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair every Monday at noon. We'll share tips, tools, and resources from leading experts to help you think bigger, better, bolder. And we'll hear inspiring stories to help you live well, live strong. Join us Monday at noon Pacific on Alternative Talk 1150.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Talk radio to help you heal and stay healthy.
Talk radio with a difference. Alternative Talk 1150 AM.
Welcome back, everyone. Welcome back. Well, my guest in this segment is Denise Moschano. She is from the Joint Commission. And as we just heard, this is an organization set up to help consumers and also to accredit medical facilities. So, Denise, I wanted to talk in this segment about some of the content that you have on your website, because, you know, I think until you have a family member go in hospital, we're all a little naive, no matter how smart we are, you know, how savvy we think we are. I think we're all a little naive about the process until we actually have to go through it with a loved one. And it's far better I know from personal experience, to know our rights and responsibilities up front than to have to try and navigate through that when you're also dealing with, you know, a loved one who might be in crisis care. So on the website, you have, you've got videos up there, you've got brochures up there, all kinds of downloadable goodies for people to look at. Let's talk about the new Speak Up video that you have, Know Your Rights. Why did you put this together?
The latest video, the Speak Up, Know Your Rights, really came, again, from feedback from organizations that this was a key area. And as you had just mentioned, Vicki, when you're in the healthcare organization unexpectedly and you're dealing with a loved one that's critically ill, it's important to know those rights at the beginning so you can kind of help guide the appropriate care for both you and for your loved one. So that really was part of the emphasis for creating the new Speak Up, Know Your Rights cartoon.
Right. You know, a lot of people are not very comfortable speaking up to doctors. You know, I'm obviously from England. There used to be this, it's a little different now, but there used to be this very hierarchical structure there with doctors. You couldn't approach them in a hospital. You'd have to talk through the matron, or you'd have to make a special appointment. So a lot of people still, I think, have some of that, you know, intimidation factor going on when they're dealing with doctors. But we all have the right to be informed about what kind of care we're going to receive. How do you advise that people who are shy about coming forward begin a dialogue with their medical professional?
Oh, that's a great question and a big concern, like you had said, when folks are new to organizations. I think, you know, the most important thing is to start with whichever healthcare provider they feel the most comfortable discussing items with first. For many folks, that's either their nurse or the doctor directly involved with their care. And it doesn't have to be a big conversation. You know, if there's a test or a treatment that they're about to either consent to, or if the healthcare provider is about to start a test on them, just say, why are we doing this test? What do we expect to learn from this test? Is there any risk to doing the test? Or is there a risk if I choose not to do the test? And just kind of having a conversation in that manner is really the best way to start.
Yeah. And we should say that in each of your brochures and the videos, the speak up that we're talking about is, you know, we want to have a voice and we want to speak up. But it's also in an acronym that you use throughout the brochure just to explain to people, you know, what they need to do. It's really critical. I know this from having dealt with sick relatives in the hospital, that we pay particular attention to the care that they get, to the medications they're getting. We can't assume. And again, I know this from personal experience, that every nurse and every doctor is familiar with every medication out there and why it's important and why it's not important, why it's important not to mix certain drugs together. So how do we, if we have a loved one in the hospital who can't speak for themselves, what is the best approach? I mean, you know, I'll share a personal story with you. My mother recently passed away. When she was in hospital, we didn't look at her hospital file. Had we looked at it, you know, I'm not saying things would have turned out differently, but there were definite questions in that hospital file, definite contradictions from different doctors. So as a loved one, when we have a loved one in hospital, how do we make sure that we have access to that kind of information?
That's a great question, and that's actually one of the key elements that we talk about in Speak Up. Pardon me. There's two different ways. One important thing is if your loved one has a formal durable power of attorney for health care, that's a primary person that can help be involved in decisions of care, but also designating an advocate. And an advocate really is a family member or a friend or the person that can be there during those difficult times when you're in the hospital. You know, you had mentioned with your mother and her experience, and certainly I've had experience with loved ones with critical illness in the hospital. And when you're there, you have a difficulty understanding what's going on when you're having the emotions and things going on. So an advocate really is that person to kind of step back and to digest the information maybe that you may not be able to hear at the time because of your concerns and your emotions. So that person can really help speak up and work with you on your behalf to make decisions for your loved ones.
Yeah. And how easy is it for people to access the medical files and actually take a look at those?
Well, it's actually a little bit challenging on purpose. So there are forms that most organizations require or states require to have that formal designation of either an advocate or a durable power for attorney for healthcare, and that's really to protect everyone's confidentiality.
Sure.
But once that form is signed, then that person, as long as you give them permission, can have access to your medical records and can be involved in making those healthcare decisions.
Yeah, and I can tell you without any doubt in my mind, if I have another loved one in hospital, I will make sure I have access to those files.
Yeah.
Just to give listeners an example, the hospital had put a DNR on my mother, which none of us were aware of until I retrieved those files after she died.
Mm.
So, you know, these are important things that we wished we had known up front.
Absolutely.
So, let's talk about how we can help prevent errors in our care, because we all know, I think it's over 100,000 people. I can't remember the specific numbers, but in America, over 100,000 people a year die through error in hospital, human error. So what's really important here in paying attention to the care that we get? What do we really need to focus in on to make sure that there aren't any errors in our care?
Well, that's a great question. You know, doctors and nurses want to take excellent care of patients, and they can do that best when patients are involved in their own care. That's one of the big tenets within the Speak Up campaign, is really to make sure that you're involved in the decisions that are made related to your care. So certainly, if there's questions, if you don't have an understanding, even if you don't know the name of one of the nurses or doctors that's coming into the room to care for you, you have the right to speak up and ask who they are, what's going on with your care. That's very important. There's a lot of other things that you can do is certainly to educate yourself related to your illness. So making sure that you understand what the illness is about and what the normal care and treatment are. If there's a new treatment being proposed, what does that mean? Another very important area is to make sure that you understand the medications that you're taking and why you're taking them. That's key for many reasons. Certainly when you first go into the hospital, the healthcare providers need to know what you're taking then. But also, there's if you're more familiar with your medications when you're in the hospital, if there's a new or a foreign medicine, that gives you the ability to ask questions about it, understand why there's been a change in your treatment regimen.
Yeah, I think that's critical because, you know, this is no reflection on nurses and doctors even. I mean, it's impossible to keep up with all the medications out there.
Right.
I've talked with hundreds of doctors over the last few years, and they all say the same thing. It's just impossible to keep up with everything. And especially if you're, a junior nurse, maybe, somebody's either the patient themselves, if they can't speak for them, then their family certainly has to be there to monitor the, meds they have to have on a daily basis are still being incorporated into their care. Let's talk about people who are at home, Denise, because many people receive treatment at home. They have caregivers come in. What are some of the key points there that we need to focus on?
It pretty much is the same. So still being involved in the treatment decisions, making sure that you understand what the normal course of care is. Medications at home is another key area. A lot of errors can occur from medications at home, especially right after being discharged from the hospital when lots of changes to your medications occur. So all those aspects are important.
Right.
Another important thing is to make sure that all the different healthcare providers that are taking care of you are talking to one another. Many people go to their family doctor for one element and maybe a heart doctor for a heart problem that they have and a lung doctor. Just making sure that everyone has access to all the information about your care is vital.
Right, right. And you talk about this in several of your brochures, and in particular in the one that where people are coming into your home because they're, I know in the case of my mother, for example, we had many carers coming in and out through the course of a day for years. But make sure that, if people aren't washing their hands around you, make sure they do that before they touch you and they touch your medicines and all that kind of stuff. And you talk about that, and it seems such a little thing, and some people might not like to say, well, could you wash your hands before you do that, please? But it's pretty important, isn't it?
Absolutely. That is key. And actually, there's being a culture shift in the public and within healthcare organizations that nurses and doctors are getting more used to patients asking that. So please don't feel embarrassed or feel like you're making your healthcare provider uncomfortable. It's really what we're used to as normal practice to say, hey, I'm sorry, I didn't see you wash your hands. Do you mind doing that before you examine me?
Right, right. This I did not know until I read some of your brochures, that every person has a right to receive information about their care in their own language. Mm-hmm. So I have a friend actually from Spain who does this for a living. She is on call to go out to hospitals and translate for Spanish-speaking people. But talk to us a little bit about that program.
Yeah, that's a key right that has been added recently, that it is important that regardless of your ethnic background, your culture, your language, you don't have any discrimination in your care. And that includes being able to understand the materials that are being provided to you, what the treatment plan is. So organizations are absolutely required to provide translation services for key elements of your care. That can come in many different forms. I'm sure you can imagine in some areas with a lot of diverse cultures and backgrounds, there's many different languages spoken. So that can either be in-person translation services, written materials in your native language. Many organizations use a telephone service now that can translate up to 100 different languages in real time. So that's another way that organizations get at it.
Wow. Wow. And we're almost at the end of our segment now. So what kind of tips do you have for a doctor's visit? How do we prepare?
Well, a great thing when you're getting ready to go to the doctor's visit is certainly write your questions down so that you have time, you can think and prepare before you go there. You know, you have a short time with your doctor when you're in at a medical office visit. So if you have everything written down, you can make sure that you don't miss anything important. Another key thing is to bring in all the medications that you have so your doctor can see exactly what you're taking and make sure that there's no duplications or things as your doctor changes your care plan. Those are key elements as you get ready. And then certainly when you're at your doctor's visit, if the doctor orders any new labs or any changes in your medication, that you speak up and ask questions and make sure that you understand that new plan.
Yeah, very good advice. And tips for the examination you have, of course, you know, don't be afraid to ask them to wash their hands or change their gloves. Mm-hmm. And if you don't feel comfortable being examined by that doctor, then you have a right to speak up about that.
Absolutely. And that is a key point. So regardless of the type of healthcare provider that you have, if you're not comfortable with that individual performing the examination, you can absolutely ask for another healthcare provider. You can certainly ask to have your advocate or your patient, your family member present, and that way you're more comfortable with that examination as well. That is certainly within your right.
Yeah. Well, Denise Machena, I really appreciate you being with us today. The Joint Commission has got some really terrific stuff up on its website. What final thoughts would you like to leave our listeners with today?
Well, again, you know, the most important thing is that we're trying to do is to make sure that patients are informed and involved in their health care and that everyone feels comfortable to speak up and ask questions so that they can really be at the center of their care.
Yeah. And would you tell listeners your website so if they want to look up the videos or download some of these brochures that you have, they can do so?
Yeah, absolutely. It's www.jointcommission, it's all one word, .org.
All right.
And also the same on YouTube for the videos.
Yeah, the videos are really cute, by the way. They're animated and they're very, very short, so you don't have to sit there and watch a whole bunch of stuff to get the message across. Denise Machena, thank you so much for being with us today. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Vicki. I appreciate the opportunity.
And please do stay with us when we come back. We're going to talk about rainy brains and sunny brains. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Stand up and I've been shut down. You're the best thing that I've ever found.
If you love dogs, tune in to The Dog Show with Julie Forbes live every Wednesday from 2 to 3 p.m. We'll talk about everything dog and interview authors, experts, and amazing organizations both locally and nationally. And don't even get me started on the pet food industry. I'm Julie Forbes. Find us online at www.dogradioshow.com and also as a free podcast on iTunes. The Dog Show with Julie Forbes, an evolved perspective on life with dogs.
Are you a foodie? Do you love to eat, shop, blog?
Do you dream of cooking your way to success? And on another note, what happens when someone at work takes credit for your idea? How do you feel when someone invents something you thought of years ago? And do you have a big idea that you'd like to get off the ground? We'll answer these questions and more on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair every Monday at noon. We'll share tips, tools, and resources from leading experts to help you think bigger, better, bolder. And we'll hear inspiring stories to help you live well, live strong. Join us Monday at noon Pacific on Alternative Talk 1150.
Hi, this is Vicki St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772. Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicki St. Clair.
Don't touch that dial. You might miss something life-changing. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Situation's terrible. But baby, you're adorable. And no need with
care. Welcome back, everyone. I need some caffeine today, I'm telling you. I want to just add a couple things to the conversation that we just had. And this is learned from bitter personal experience. You know, we all have these learning experiences in our life. But I just want to share something with you. You know, when my mother was rushed into hospital, my brother followed the paramedics to the hospital, him and his wife. After he left her that night, she had a cardiac arrest about an hour after he left her. And they did at that point resuscitate her. But none of us knew that until my brother went to visit the next day because they lost his contact information. Now, you know, this is something that you just assume that once you've given the hospital or the administrator the contact information, that they're going to have that in the file. And when I was going through my mother's file after she passed away, I saw several times throughout her whole file, no contact information, next of kin not known. If you could only understand how much effort my brother, my sister and I have put in over the last 10 years to make sure that she was really well cared for and received the best possible care. And then, you know, to have her let down like that when she most needed it was horrifying. But so, you know, lesson learned, we can't assume anything. And I share that with you because I think, you know, in times of crisis, we think we've done our best. I just say double check and triple check because we can't assume anything. Don't leave anything to chance. And again, I mentioned in that discussion with Donice Machano from the Joint Commission that, you know, if this happens again with a loved one, I will definitely make sure I have access to their medical records while they're in hospital. And I will be checking those medical records several times a day because there was such contradictory information in there. That, again, was absolutely shocking and something that shouldn't have happened. But, you know, we're dealing with human beings, and I'm not saying anybody's a bad person, but, you know, as Denise pointed out, we often are speaking with so many different medical professionals. They're not even on the same teams. They're not paid by the same group, even though it's under the same hospital. There's a lot going on there. And even though you think we thought we were doing the best we could, my brother was there constantly. My sister was there constantly. I called in the middle of the night when the night shift nurses came on to make sure that they knew, hey, this isn't a woman who nobody cares about. You know, we still didn't have a happy outcome there. But anyway, so I share that with you, you know, as hopefully you don't have to go through something like that. All right, we're going to shift gears now. We're going to talk about rainy brains and sunny brains. Mr. Eric Ryder, do you have a rainy brain or a sunny brain?
You know, if you're saying that rainy means pessimistic and sunny means optimistic, I think I'm somewhere in between. I may have a rainy brain, but I've got an umbrella for it. So,
love it. I love it. Well, that's a good thing. So, You know, I was curious if optimists are born, because I was married to somebody who was a very jovial fellow. I mean, very jovial. But he could be such a pessimist.
Mm.
And it's really hard when you're an optimist to deal with that pessimism.
Yeah.
When you look and think, well, there's no point to be pessimistic about that because I can't control it.
Right.
But so I wondered, are we born optimists? Are we born pessimists? And can we change? And what are what my guest calls true optimists? So I talked with Professor Elaine Fox. Let me introduce a little bit about Elaine. She's a psychologist and neuroscientist. She's researched widely on the science of emotions. She's worked at St. James Hospital Dublin, Victoria University of Wellington in New Zealand, and she's been a visiting senior scientist at the MRC Cognition and Brain Sciences Unit in Cambridge. She's currently the visiting research professor in the Department of Experimental Psychology at the University of Oxford. She's a fellow of Magdalen College, Oxford, and director of the Effective Neuroscience Laboratory in the Department of Psychology at the University of Essex. And there she leads a research program combining cognitive psychology, neuroimaging, and genetics. And she's one of the leading experts in the field. She's the person that the media turns to and other scientists turn to when they have questions on this subject. She's written a really smart, smooth-reading book. It's called Rainy Brain, Sunny Brain, How to Retrain Your Brain to Overcome Pessimism and Achieve a More Positive Outlook. And so I sat down with her a couple of weeks ago. This is the first time we're bringing this interview to you, but she's back in England. And so I sat down with her one morning and we talked about this subject. And we're going to bring that recording to you now for the first time. After the recording, I'm going to tell you, after the interview, I'm going to tell you. Now, I'm sure that I'm talking to the women out there. Have you ever wondered, you know, why that guy who lives down the road or is in the nightclub or bugs you at dinner, why that guy who looks like Archie Bunker thinks he's James Bond? Well, it turns out there might be a scientific reason behind that. And I'm going to share that with you after we've talked with Professor Elaine Fox. Well, Elaine, I want to welcome you to the show today. Pleased to have you with us.
Thanks so much, Vicky.
Your book is called Rainy Brain, Sunny Brain, sparks all kinds of ideas, especially for us up here in Seattle. But I want to, first of all, just talk a little bit about you and share a little more about you with our listeners. I know that you're a leading experimental psychologist. You're an expert on the science of optimism. Tell us what drove you to this path.
Okay, well, my background is really in psychology and neuroscience. And like many psychologists, I started off studying the more negative side of things. So a lot of my research was very much focused on anxiety and depression and a pessimistic mindset. And a lot of my research was looking at, you know, we know that the brains of anxious people, you know, people tend to be tuned in very rapidly to the negative side of things. So my research looks a lot at cognitive biases and the idea that people are their brains tune in very quickly to the negative type of things. But over time, I began to really ask, well, what about optimism and what about people who are very resilient? So I started studying people who are very, very resilient, who, you know, no matter what life threw at them, they seem to be very well able to cope. So I kind of wondered, well, is this just the opposite of pessimism, where people are more vulnerable, or are there other elements to resilience and to optimism? And in fact, now we've actually learned an awful lot about optimism and discovered it's not just the opposite of pessimism. There's actually a lot of other components, and many of those other components are pretty crucial, I think, to some of the benefits that come with them being more optimistic and being more resilient.
Yes, it's quite fascinating. And I mean, I found this a fascinating read. I can see why you get engrossed in your work. Is it, you know, often we've thought of pessimism, you're a born pessimist or you're born optimism. Talk to us a little bit about your research, because I know that sparked a great deal of conversation about maybe a possible optimism gene.
That's right. And, you know, more recently I've been looking at certain sets of genes to see are there particular genes involved. And what we've found is that there certainly are genes which are involved. And what those genes do is we know they affect the neurochemicals in our brain that underlie these rainy brain and sunny brain circuits. So the genes definitely tip the balance to some extent. They nudge the brain either towards a more positive way of looking at things or a more negative way of looking at things. But I think one of the things I really try to point out in the book is that there really isn't any such thing as an optimism gene. You know, a lot of people want to think that there's a particular gene that will make you an optimist. If you have that gene, you'll be an optimist or you'll be a pessimist. Now, it shouldn't be a surprise to find that life isn't as simple as that. You know, life is actually far more complex, and I think far more interesting. The story, I think, is actually far more interesting than that. And what we now know is that genes are definitely important, but they really operate very much in a very subtle way with the environment. So to give you a good example, there's a very nice study done, published about in the early 2000s. Again, a great study which followed people over about a 23-year period, so a very long-term study. And what the researchers wanted to know was whether if people had a short version of a particular gene, would that lead to more depression? And there were good biological reasons to think that. So what they found after the 23 years, when they looked at people with a short version of this gene, they were very surprised to find that actually the gene didn't seem to be linked to higher rates of depression. However, when they then looked at the number of life experiences people had had, what they found was that people who had the short version of the gene and had three or more pretty nasty life experiences, so pretty adverse things happening to them, then the risk of depression increased dramatically. So in other words, the genes alone weren't enough to lead to depression. The bad things happening alone weren't enough to lead to depression, but both together were quite a toxic combination. So we know genes are important and we know environments are important, but what our research is now looking at is how those genes and environments really work together to lead to either a more rainy brain or sunny brain type of system.
Interesting. And you say that your theory is that the spark at the source of the sunny brain is the pleasure center, I'm quoting from the book here, the pleasure center deep in the ancient regions of our neural tissue. You say all of us crave pleasure, but some of us bring it to the verge of addiction. And we might think of adrenaline junkies. You share a story of a boy called David in the book. Talk to us a little bit about that pleasure center and how it can lead to addiction.
Yes, absolutely. Well, I think there's two very ancient systems in our brain. So one is the fear system, which we know we share with almost every creature on the planet. That helps us tune into danger very rapidly. And we also have an ancient pleasure system, again, a very ancient system in evolutionary terms. And the pleasure system is there to really pull us towards things that are good for us. If you think, if you pair it back, if you look at the absolute, you know, these are the great biological motivators, if you like. The two most important things for survival, in a sense, are to be able to notice danger and to be drawn towards things that are good for you. Now, fear will always trump the pleasure system, in a sense. It's, you know, as I say in the book, I think it's far better to have lunch than to be lunch.
Our ancestors needed to be pretty quickly.
But at the same time, the pleasure system is there to pull us towards good things. So things that are obviously shelter, food, sex, all of those things which are important for survival of both ourselves and for the species. We have these very ancient systems that draw us towards that. Now, of course, if those systems get hyperactive and get out of control, that can actually bring us to the verge of addiction. And that's obviously where we can get problems. Likewise, on the other side, with the fear system, if the fear system gets out of control, that's where we start getting into anxiety. So people start seeing danger everywhere. So really, it sounds a little bit, you know, it's almost like what our grandmothers would have told us. But in many ways, it's having the balance. If we can keep those two systems in balance and everything in moderation, that is actually the healthiest mindset we can have. So having a kind of a healthy pleasure system and being able to take pleasure in things, but also having a healthy fear system is actually what is the best kind of healthy mindset to have.
So it's all about balance. So, you know, Eric, when you said at the beginning you have an optimist, but you have that umbrella there ready.
I've the rainy brain, but I've got the umbrella there to help.
Yeah, there's some merit in that. So we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, I'll continue talking with Professor Elaine Fox, and we're going to talk about how we can get that balance. And she talks about optimists and how they have more positive experiences than negative ones, and why pessimists need to build that into their daily schedule. So please stay tuned. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. We're talking about Rainy Brain, Sunny Brain with Elaine Fox.
is a bright canary yellow. I forget every cloud I've ever seen. So they call me a cockeyed optimist, immature and incurably green. I have heard people rant.
Do something different with your spare time. Give baby animals at Paws a fresh start. With the assistance of caring volunteers, Paws helps hundreds of orphaned and sick kittens and puppies each year. Join us and save lives. Become a Paws foster care volunteer. For more information, visit paws.org or 425-787-2500. Paws.org or 425-787-2500.
At Sundown Communications, we find that most of our clients are brilliant at what they do, but they lack the time and resources to write and create business messaging that delivers results. That's where we come in, providing a diverse range of professional copywriting services for fresh strategic web content, PR, advertising and promotion, marketing, speeches, and much more. Call us today so you can focus on what you do best, and we'll do the rest. Call 800-495-7617. That's 800-495-7617.
Who is Chopra?
What is Chopra?
When is Chopra?
Joe Janeau is the host of a brand new show called Chopra. Joe has been nicknamed Chopra by his friends and colleagues who find his advice and insight to be enlightening, just like a certain other talk show host of world renown. Born and raised in Seattle, independent-minded Joe Janeau is bringing issues to the airwaves that make you ponder, laugh, and deliberate. The Chopra Show is about the ins and outs of food and drink, relationships, entertainment, and so much more. Get to know Chopra every Thursday at 2, right here on Alternative Talk 1150.
Are you a foodie? Do you love to eat, shop, blog? Do you dream of cooking your way to success? And on another note, what happens when someone at work takes credit for your idea? How do you feel when someone invents something you thought of years ago? And do you have a big idea that you'd like to get off the ground? We'll answer these questions and more on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair every Monday at noon. We'll share tips, tools, and resources from leading experts to help you think bigger, better, bolder. And we'll hear inspiring stories to help you live well, live strong. Join us Monday at noon Pacific on Alternative Talk 1150.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Find out about upcoming shows at conversationslive.net.
1150kknw.com. It's why they invented the internet. We think. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
But I'm only a cockeyed optimist, and I can't get it into my head. I hear the human race.
And welcome back. And if you can't guess, we're talking about optimism today. Optimism and pessimism. And, you know, I mentioned my mom earlier, and this song, The Cockeyed Optimist, was one of her all-time favorites from the movie South Pacific. Larry Hagman's mother sang that. Mary, I've forgotten her last name. But anyway, it's just a song that stuck in my heart because I heard it a million times when I was growing up. And so we're going to rejoin the conversation with Professor Elaine Fox. I sat down with her, as I said, a couple of weeks ago, and this is the first time we're bringing this discussion to you. And we're talking about some of the stuff in her new book. She's the author of Rainy Brain, Sunny Brain. She's also the leading expert on the subject of optimism. She's the go-to person for other scientists and researchers, and she's very much in demand in talking about this subject. And before the break, we were talking about the importance of getting balance. You know, we're not going to have sunny days every day. But
especially not up here.
Well, that's why I love the title of this book right. So much, Rainy Brain, Sunny Brain. I thought it was going to be about Seattle, but she didn't actually mention it. But she talks about the importance of getting that balance and including positive daily activities in our lives. And, you know, what I learned from reading the book was that optimists have more positive than negative experiences or activities. And that's no accident. So they know intrinsically that no matter what life throws at them, they will get through it. So let's go back to the conversation with Professor Elaine Fox. You say most optimists engage in three enjoyable activities for every one they wish they could avoid.
right. I mean, this is actually very interesting work by a psychologist called Barbara Friedrichsen, and so I talk about her research, and it's really, really interesting research, and we've done some similar work and found very similar things. And the interesting thing is, what we find is that people who are very optimistic and resilient, they actually tend to experience a wide range of emotions. It's not that they have lots of positive things and virtually no negative things, but the crucial thing is the ratio. So in other words, it doesn't matter to some extent how many negative things you experience or how many negative emotions you experience. So by negative emotions, I mean things like your fear and anger and sadness. In a sense, the crucial thing is having the ratio right. So people who are really, you know, experiencing, if you like, people who are flourishing and doing very well, they will tend to have three positive experiences for every one negative. So in other words, every time you have a row with your partner, you should make sure you've got three nice things to make up for it. So it's really, you know, it's really the balance. But I think this is actually a very interesting finding, because a lot of people kind of feel if people are going through a particular bad time, they may have lots of negative experiences. And if someone's going through a bereavement, for example, the people who are very resilient and the people who get through that very well are people who will be somehow able to have some positive emotions in that as well. So it's not so much we should be trying to suppress the negative stuff, it's just we need to try and ensure that we have enough positive things to counteract the negative.
Yeah, I'm actually going through that myself. I just lost my mother, and it does come over you very suddenly, and those are the times when I think, okay, I've got 5 minutes to be miserable, or I turn on some of her favorite music and it kind of cheers me up a bit. But it's that balance. I want to talk, because I know we don't have much time, I want to talk about what you call true optimists, optimistic realists. You say optimism is not just about feeling good, and we kind of touched on that. It's about being engaged with a meaningful life, developing resilience, feeling in control. Talk to us a little bit about the true optimist.
Okay, well, this is one of the really interesting things that we found in our research. I think a lot of us, when we think of optimism, we think about positive thinking. And of course, positive thinking is a part of optimism, but it's not the only part. And what our research is telling us is that it's probably not the most important part in terms of the benefits of optimism. So, if we think about it, just sitting back passively and thinking everything is going to be wonderful isn't actually a very sensible way of looking at things. So, if we look at the other elements of optimism, one of the key things we know about optimists is that they have a real sense of control over their life. It's an absolute key element of optimism. People feel that they have a little bit of control, whereas people who are very pessimistic often tend to have the feeling that, you know, lots of things are happening around them and there's not very much they can do about it, so they're kind of out of control. Now, having a sense that you have some control over your own destiny is actually very empowering, and it's one of the important elements of optimism that I think is linked to the benefits of optimism. Another element of optimism is persistence. We know optimists they tend to get out there and do things and try out new things, and they tend to persist and persist and persist. There's a nice example I give in the book from Thomas Edison, the guy who invented the light bulb, and he was trying to develop an electric lamp. He was going through his notebooks and realized that he'd tried out thousands and thousands of ways to try and invent an electric lamp. And he famously said, "We haven't failed. We've just found 10,000 ways that don't work." I think that gives you a kind of an insight to the mind of the optimist. And it's nothing to do with positive thinking. It's to do with this kind of persistence and continuing. And it's those kind of parts of optimism that are almost certainly the components that are linked with the greater success that we know optimists have in, say, business, for example, but also in terms of health. Just this idea of, you know, of acting in the world, persistence, and having a sense of control, and also just really having a good sense of pleasure, going back to what we were talking about earlier in being able to take pleasure in things. All of those are key components of optimism over and above positive thinking. So I think that, you know, positive thinking alone, or putting your head in the sand and just thinking everything is going to be wonderful, isn't actually going to bring you much benefit. But the kind of optimism that does bring benefit is an optimism tied in with this kind of sense of realism. So just to give you an example, like one optimist I talked to, or a typical thing that lots of people I interviewed actually said, was that it's not that they think that nothing is ever, that everything's going to go right. You know, most people are aware that some things won't go well. You know, I may not get that job I want, you know, I might fail an exam, but an optimist will kind of have the sense that no matter what happens, even if things don't work out well, overall they know they'll be able to cope. They have a deep-rooted belief that they'll be able to cope. And they'll actually go out there and try out different things and different ways of doing things. And it's all of that, it's those wider aspects of optimism that I think are really the things that are one of are the reasons why optimism is actually quite good for us.
Yes, and this is a really great book, and you have solutions in here for people who do tend to think a little pessimistically. So I want to just ask you what you'd like to leave our listeners with today. If they took nothing else away from this conversation, what's the one thing you'd like them to take away?
I think the one thing to take away is that our particular mindset isn't set in stone. So whether you want to change or not, I think even if you feel you're really very pessimistic and, you know, you can't change, I think people can change. It's not easy, and one of the points I make in the book is there's no easy solution. It's a bit like if you want to get fit and going to the gym, you know, you have to stick with it and work with it. And I think it's exactly the same in terms of retraining our brain. We know now that there are techniques where we can overcome very pessimistic mindsets, but it takes time and it takes effort. But I think the positive thing is we know that we can actually change if we really put the effort in.
Well, Elaine Fox, I want to thank you for being with us and thank you for the great work you're doing and helping us optimists be more realistic and the pessimists get more optimistic.
That's great. Thanks very much, Vicky.
Thank you so much.
Well, I'm going to share with you now, we talked about this at the beginning of the segment, I'm going to share with you now the reason that pot-bellied men with hair growing out their ears still think they look like James Bond. And this is not to pick on men, okay? You'll understand there is a very valid, maybe a very valid, legitimate reason, scientific reason, why the Archie Bunker types think they look like James Bond. And there were a series of studies done where male managers interacted with female employees or male professors interacted with students, etc. And as a result of those, they developed what is called the error management theory. And the consensus around this study was that men are limited in the number of people they can mate with from an evolutionary perspective. There's a high cost of missing out on an opportunity to procreate, whereas the pain of rejection is more short-lived and not overly costly. Therefore, the scientists agreed that it pays for men to overestimate how appealing they are to women. Mm. And therefore, the seeds of optimism, realistic or otherwise, are sown.
Interesting. I don't think that goes for all men, though.
No,
I mean
no.
A lot of us.
But there are men
often and, underestimate,
you know, and often you know, their wives and spouses and family will joke, well, he thinks, you know, he's James Bond. I'm
right.
Saying James Bond, but whoever, you know, and
there any
he is
smooth
with
character.
a big paunch and hair growing out his ears and his nose.
Right.
So anyway, I thought that was kind of interesting. So we're going to run through real quick. Elaine had some tips in her book about if you do tend towards mild pessimism. Obviously, if you are very pessimistic, you need to seek medical help. But if you have mild pessimism, give us a high level overview of what we can do.
Sure. Well, these four steps, as you say, come from her book. And she says, number one, make a daily tally of negative and positive events.
Yeah, and she just says, create a list starting from when you wake up in the morning of all the things that go right and wrong, and for basically, so you're just tracking and becoming more aware.
Number two, aim for three positive experiences for every one negative one.
Yeah, and as she said in the interview, most optimists engage in three enjoyable activities for every one. So if you're going through a hard time right now, you need to make more time in your day for fun.
Treat yourself.
Yeah.
Number three, exercise every day.
I think that's a given. We all know it releases serotonin, the happy drug.
But is that a positive experience or a negative one? Ever exercise?
Well, the release of serotonin is a good one. Or you could just eat chocolate.
There you go. Number four, engage in mindfulness meditation.
Yeah, and we know we need to learn to be present in the moment. And this whole book is based on, you know, solid, cutting edge scientific research, but they also blend in there the importance of ancient wisdom, Eastern wisdom. So I thought it was a really good book. Hope you enjoyed the interview. And it's the book again is called Rainy Brain, Sunny Brain, How to Retrain Your Brain to Overcome Pessimism and Achieve a More Positive Outlook. And how much time do I have left?
We still got a minute here.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So we are celebrating our fifth anniversary on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair this month.
I still can't believe it. I'm still...
8 years I've been looking at your face because I was here for 3 years.
That's true. That's true.
Choice.
Yeah.
And you've had to look at mine too. But
I think we still look pretty good. Maybe I'm just being optimistic, but I think both of us still look pretty good.
Yeah. I think there's a reason your eyes go as you go older. You can't see the gray hair and the wrinkles. I think that, you know, look from an optimist point of view, that's pretty good.
That's a good point. There's a silver lining to everything, isn't there?
There is.
Even if it's just our hairline.
Right. Well, we're going to be back next week. We're going to look at some of the highlights of the last 5 years, and I hope you will join us then. Thank you for being with us today. Really appreciate it. Love to hear feedback from you. info@conversationslive.net is where you can reach me. We'll see you next week. Until then, live well, live strong.
Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.